Well, I guess welcome to ground zero when it comes to Stand Your Ground. In the interest of time, I'm going to be brief here and not go through the full introduction. Our next speaker's bio is in your packet, so you can read it there. And it's my pleasure to introduce to you one of America's most noted criminal defense attorneys, Mark O'Mara. Mark?
Good morning. How you doing? Great when you're sitting there and you're the next one up and then you hear the two speakers before you talking about your subject. So, okay, takes it away a little bit. I did read the Sentinel yesterday and noticed that, let me make sure I get it right, that I am going to address the crowd about his client's view, his use of deadly force and the international attention. So does anyone, if anyone's here just to hear me talk about Mr. Zimmerman's use of force that day, I can spend the next 20 minutes doing that, but I've got to give up my bar card first. So it really, this is not an opportunity to talk about the Zimmerman case, and quite honestly shouldn't be. Though the case has gotten an enormous amount of attention based upon just some things that happened in the beginning. This case really needs to be tried in a courtroom or to a judge, and we'll talk about those possibilities here in a minute. And even though it certainly caused an enormous amount of media discourse and public discourse, which I think is very healthy to have, we really can't be talking about the facts of the case. And the one thing that I started talking about, the only thing I really said in the beginning of this case, was to all those people who had already made up their mind about the case and had some very visceral reactions to the tragedy that happened that night, was that they had to know less than I did, because I at least had some insight on the case, and I knew very little. So what I said to them was, please wait. Just take your time. Wait until you get the evidence. If you make a decision before the evidence, it's absurd. It might be the right decision, who knows, by pure coincidence, but it will never be a proper decision. So I continue to say that we should wait until we have all the evidence in, and quite honestly, maybe half or more of it is in, even that I know, because we're just starting our process. So for those of you here, for those of you through the media, and for those of you out there who have already made up your mind, it can't be right. Coincidentally, maybe, but accurately, absolutely not, because the facts aren't out. And there are standards that need to be applied before you make those decisions. So let's talk about that a little bit. I can upset everybody in here by saying that I think the Second Amendment's already been amended. We may not have realized it, but that's okay with an amendment, because what it really says is that you have the right to keep and bear arms reasonably. If you look at any of the federal case law and the state case law, what it really says is that we're going to restrict how we use our firearms, how we use our right to protect ourselves, and it's got to be reasonable. We keep it from children. I think that's a good idea. We keep it from felons. I think it's a good idea. They're trying to shut me down. You know, what we've done is we've looked at it as states get more populous, and we need to be more careful with the way we interact. Florida came up with a statute that tries to codify some common law sense, common sense that has existed for a long, long time. And John Guttmacher mentioned it, stole some of my thunder. But the idea of the Castle Doctrine of Stand Your Ground, or the duty not to retreat, has been around for literally hundreds of years. It existed in English common law long before we were ever a country, and we adopted it even earlier than 1985, but it was the Beard versus United States case back in 1985, where the Supreme Court said, you have that right. You have the right to in your place, in your home particularly, to be secure. And that was the initial concept of the Castle Doctrine. Well, and then we can fast forward through all the federal statutes and fast forward through other state statutes and how we've reacted to it. But what I was going to do today, if you would like, is just spend a few minutes going over what is known as the Justifiable Use of Force Act or statute, because after all, that really is supposed to be our playbook for how we react and interact with each other, particularly when the use of force, whether that includes weapons or guns or not. So, 2005, we looked at the legislature, and I think a couple of the people who helped out with that are here, looked at it and determined that we needed to revamp and to codify the justifiable use of force. And if you look at the statute, that's exactly what it's called. It's Florida Statute 776, Justifiable Use of Force. And what it does is it gives us a roadmap not necessarily to tell you what to do, because I don't think anybody reads the statute and then in a moment of crisis says, okay, subsection 4, sub 3, sub B says I can do this. What it really was meant to do was to take the reality of what people go through when they're in positions of trauma and tragedy and how they're going to react. And what it really does is tell the legislature, tells the courts, and hopefully it drills down to us as citizens, tells us how to act and how to review the actions of people who have had to act in certain ways because they found their lives or their friends' lives or their property in danger. So, just file for use of force under 776.012 is sort of the overall one that says what you can do to defend yourself. And if you read through it, and I can, but basically what it says is that you are allowed to use force to react to force. And that makes sense. If somebody punches you in the nose, you're allowed to punch them in the nose. If somebody does something to you, you're allowed to do something back to them. The question then becomes, and the most relevant inquiry, and the cases that get the most attention, is when that rises to the level of having to use deadly force. And what it says is that you are allowed to use deadly force if you reasonably believe. And the reasonable part is what I mentioned a moment ago with the Second Amendment and the way that we're sort of modifying it in its application. If you use a weapon in Florida, and you do so unreasonably, get prosecuted. As long as the decision of whether or not you used it reasonably was through your mind at the time it happened. And that's basically what the statute says. If you reasonably believe that you're in fear of great bodily injury or death, but you know the lesser standard is one we have to look at, are you reasonably in fear of great bodily injury? And great bodily injury is determined by the statute and by the courts that interpret it to say what is great bodily injury, and that's what courts are for. But if you, as you're in the moment, believe that you are in reasonable fear of great bodily injury, then you are allowed to respond to that using force up to and including deadly force. And basically, that's been self-defense for as long as we have had laws, not just in this country, but in the countries before us. Because it basically says you, not only through our Constitution, but even through English common law, you have the right to be secure in your own person. You're allowed to protect yourself. Well, that's exactly what our statute codifies. It does add to it the question that has now been the benchmark, or almost the flashpoint, this duty to retreat, this stand your ground. Let's spend a moment talking about what standing ground is and what it is not. If there is a spectrum, if you will, of what you're allowed to do when to use self-defense, to act in response to a threat with force, even including deadly force. Well, if you think about it this way, our statute was amended to say, if you perceive, reasonably believe, that you're in fear of deadly force, great bodily injury, or death, then you can respond to that with deadly force. And it says you don't need to retreat. So, if you were to go through all of those cases that talk about stand your ground and talk about the appellate cases that John mentioned, if you really looked at it, there are very few cases where the person actually stood their ground. They're called stand your ground hearings, but not by me and not anymore. The hearing that exists under the statute, interpreted by the courts under State versus Dennis, is called a self-defense immunity hearing, because that's, after all, what it is. Are you immune having used or acted in self-defense? In the very few percentage of the cases, way over here on the end of the spectrum, are those cases where the person had an opportunity to retreat. So, in effect, I get confronted with potential deadly force, or I have reasonable belief that I am going to suffer great bodily injury. Someone's going to hit me and blacken my eye or break a rib or whatever is considered to be great bodily force, at least as I perceive it. So if that happens to me and I have a gun, then under the statute, I don't have to retreat. I can stand my ground. I can react to that force using up to and including deadly force. That doesn't happen very often because, quite honestly, most people act with common sense, even in times of trauma. I agree with John that it's difficult sometimes when you're in that tunnel vision of having somebody hit you or threaten you or point a gun at you. But still, we tend to react somewhat reasonably. And if you have a gun, and if somebody's threatening you with great bodily injury, the standard which would allow you to use deadly force without retreating, and you can retreat, most people would, and most people do. The fear with this statute was all of a sudden we're going to get this cowboy mentality and people are going to go, aha, I've read the statute. I've memorized it before this one traumatic event that's going to happen in my life that I never thought was going to happen. And I'm ready. I'm ready to not retreat. That wasn't the purpose of the statute. And I don't think anybody in this room or any other room that's listening to this really sits back and says, I can't wait until I don't have to retreat. That's absurd. It really is in its application and in its fear that that was going to happen. And as we look at the case that's come out to date, it hasn't come to pass. We've not turned into the cowboys that people have suggested. Now, I have said that people could interpret this statute as a right to kill statute. And let me tell you something, it's not. And if you kill just because you can and not because you have to, get prosecuted. But if you shoot or use deadly force because you have to and you decide not to retreat, our statute says that's okay. You don't have to retreat. You don't have to turn your back on the assailant for fear of what might else happen. You don't have to give the assailant another shot at you, another chance, before you react. But I really think that most of us tend to retreat if you can. If you can back away from an event without using a weapon that you know may kill, most of us do, and most of us will. And quite honestly, if you don't retreat and you're in reasonable fear of great bodily harm, the statute makes sense. But that really is the 2 or 3% far on the end of the spectrum. Most situations are those situations where you don't have the time or the ability to decide whether or not to retreat, and you simply don't retreat and you act with deadly force. And that is the primary portion of the statute that says to us, if you reasonably believe great bodily injury, then you're allowed to use deadly force. Now, I've been criticized in the Zimmerman case when I said, this isn't a stand your ground case. Whoa, what does that mean? He's giving up the statute. He doesn't like the statute. He doesn't think it should apply. It's a factual determination, that's all. John mentioned it. I really will stay away from the facts of the case. It just seems that as my interpretation of the facts of the case, that it doesn't seem as though the stand your ground exception, the spectrum end way over there, applies to the facts of this case. Will we still have a self-defense immunity hearing? Damn straight. It makes sense because this is a self-defense case. It's just that I call it a self-defense immunity hearing because, the timer went off, so I have all the time I want now. I'm going to keep talking until they do turn the lights out. So we are going to have an immunity hearing, and let's talk sort of about what the immunity hearing is and is not. Because that comes from, and there's other parts of the statute, there is 776.013, protecting your home. That's really the castle doctrine. Then there is protecting others, which gives a different level. You can only really protect another if you believe they are about to be or have a forcible felony visited upon them. Makes sense. I mean, granted, if you're going to shoot somebody because they're threatening somebody else, that person has to be subject to the intended victim, a forcible felony. And if it's a forcible felony, like aggravated battery, you're allowed to. And again, this statute doesn't tell you go do it. It just says when you react to the common sense reaction you're going to have to help try and protect your fellow man, that you're immune, you have self-defense immunity. So let's talk about what the immunity really is and what it's supposed to do. Here's what it says, and it makes sense. If you think about it, it's almost circular logic. If you do something that's right, then it's right. That's really what the immunity statute says, if you think about it. What it says is if you do what you're allowed to do, if you use deadly force, any force, but if you use deadly force in response to a situation where you're in reasonable fear of great bodily injury, or if the other person, or if you forcible felony or protecting your home, any of those circumstances, if you react to that using great or using deadly force, then you're immune. Well, it really says if you do what the statute says you can do, because you acted reasonably, then you can't get prosecuted. Well, shouldn't happen anyway, quite honestly. You shouldn't get prosecuted if you're acting reasonably, and the statute says you can. But what I do like about the statute is it sets out a procedure. Actually, the case law that interprets it sets out a procedure to tell us how we're going to handle that as lawyers and as judges. Because the problem with it is that you don't necessarily want to put all of these facts before a jury first. So what we say is, and what the case law allows us, is we will go to a judge and say to the judge, here are the facts. Judge, do you think that my client acted in reasonable fear of great bodily injury? And judge, if you think my client acted in reasonable fear of great bodily injury, determine that he or she is immune. Follow the statute. And that's really all it says. The judge gets a determination to say, well, let's see what's reasonable here. He threatened you with a knife from 30 feet away, and you shot him. Probably not reasonable. He threatened you with a knife from 3 feet away, and you shot him. Probably reasonable. I don't mind this a procedure in place that lets a judge decide prima facie or up front whether or not my client in any self-defense case acted reasonably. They know the law. They know the application. It might save some time. You don't get into as many of the emotions of the loss that may have happened because of the event. And a judge can decide that. And I'm very okay with the immunity hearing. And it makes sense. It just gives us that right to say, if you do what you had to do and you're reasonable in doing it, then you're immune from prosecution. A couple of things. I hadn't thought about it, but I really like John Guttmacher's idea that the statute should be amended to include not only what it says now. What it says now is if I'm the defendant and somebody sues me and I now have to defend myself in a civil suit and I have to go hire someone like me to hire me, to defend me, then I can get my attorney's fees back and the court costs on that civil side. Well, I'm not sure why it doesn't apply on the criminal side as well. I understand some of the systemic reasons. If I don't get convicted beyond a reasonable doubt, doesn't mean I didn't do something wrong, whatever. But what I like is the idea that if a citizen is put to task of proving that what they did right was in fact right, then they should get compensated for having to prove it. Why not? I mean, you're going to come to me and say spend thousands of dollars on an attorney to prove this up. Well, take the risk if you're going to sue me or if you're going to prosecute me. So I sort of like John's idea, and I wish it was in place on this case. It's not, but whatever. Anyway, so that is sort of a quick primer on the justifiable use of force statute, its application to when you have to use it, and what protections that the statute gives you and why it should give it to you. There are other provisions that talk about it. Obviously, law enforcement are in a particularly protected position. The presumption doesn't apply if it's against law enforcement when you know they're law enforcement. And I'm fine with that. That makes a lot of sense. They risk their lives every day to try and keep us free. There is a provision talking about the use of an aggressor. John mentioned that if a person aggressively uses force first. It's technical. We can go through it. Basically, what it says is if you're the one who starts it or provokes it, you don't get the protection of the statute. Now, you still get to argue self-defense. You just may not get the immunity that the statute would otherwise provide you. But even in that case, if I was the one to go up to him and attack him because I don't like the fact that he's wearing a bow tie, I like these kind. Even if I were to do that and I was therefore the initial provocateur of the action, if I say, you know what, maybe I'm just being a fashionista here, I back off. I withdraw. At that point, I then regain some protections from the statute. And again, no one's going to read the statute and go, okay, now I can do it, now I can back off. What it really does is say, in the normal run of our everyday lives, and we are confronted with events, and with threats particularly, and when, as John said, the blood is rushing, the adrenaline's going high, you get tunnel vision, you don't know what's going on, All you know is you are hurt or you're about to be hurt and you react, then the statute says as long as it's reasonable reaction, we're allowed to do that as citizens. And quite honestly, I don't know that the statute needs a lot of amendments. I think the court system has done a pretty good job of interpreting it. And I'm not kidding when I say to you, use a gun unreasonably, use it because you can, not because you have to, go to jail. One reason why, wrap it up, okay, the timer just got back on. One reason why is because it does denigrate the ability the rest of us have to properly use weapons, and we don't want an overreaction to it, so it just makes sense. So, having said all that, and having done what I need to do, staying away particularly from the Zimmerman case, does anybody have questions that I can answer? And there may be some I just say I can't answer. Yes, sir. I think what he's asking, so everyone knows, is somebody shoots at him, he goes for his gun, they get in a car and start driving away. Can you follow him and shoot him? Is that what you're asking? Right. Okay. Okay, so they shoot at you, you've done this before, you have no fear in your heart because you've just gotten shot at, and you then decide, I have no fear, I mean, I'm not making fun of the fact scenario, I have no fear, can I still take my gun out and shoot? I don't want to be a judge in the case, but if it was a law school exam, I would say that if you don't have reasonable fear of great bodily injury in the future, not that he shot at you in the past, that you would not... But, okay, he's continuing to shoot. And you're still not in fear? Better man than I. I don't think you get protections from the statute. I really don't know the statute is going to give you protection if you walk up in front of a judge and say, I shot him, but I had no fear of great bodily injury. I just figured he was shooting at me. I was going to see if I was a better shot. I'm not sure you're going to get protection of the statute because the statute does say that in order to get protection of the statute, to be immune, then you have to be reasonably in fear of great bodily injury. So literally, you know, and here's the other example. You know, if you are, and I know I got to wrap it up. I'm sorry. I'll finish real quickly. If you, you know, in that scenario where you can retreat, if you can retreat behind a bulletproof wall, you know, should you? Probably so. But if once you retreat behind that bulletproof wall, can you then still shoot? I would say not, because the fear is gone. But no, I'm just saying, at some point, if you don't have fear, don't use the statute. I don't think so, but it would be an interesting case to try.